And we also have the University of Wisconsin Pre-Law Society students. Would they stand, please? Good seeing you all. You may be seated. The high school students are here with a program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar Association of Wisconsin. And it's called Court with Class. The students have been given summaries of the cases as well as briefs, and they may have done some extra work on these cases by discussion or by inviting lawyers or others in to talk with them. This has been a very successful program. Not only have we won national awards, but thousands of students have participated. And we're delighted to welcome the Pre-Law Society students. And if you need information about the case you're about to hear, there is a summary, I believe, outside in the foyer, and you may leave the room and get it. In connection with the Court with Class program, but everyone in this room and people not in the room who wish to participate may do so at noon when the students and anyone else who wishes will meet with the justice of this court to talk about the procedures that the court uses in deciding cases and in taking cases. So we have met you. Now I'd like to introduce the court to you all. I'll start on my far left, Justice Diane Sykes. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. And Justice Crooks is the justice who is assigned today to meet with the students. Seated to my left is Justice John Wilcox, who we welcome back after being absent on sick leave. And I'm Shirley Abrahamson. I am the Chief Justice. And to my immediate right is Justice William Babich, and to his right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and on the far right, Justice David Prosser. With those introductions made, I now call the first case of the February arguments, 010991, Peggy Paulson versus Allstate Insurance. And we'll hear first from counsel representing Allstate Insurance Company. Mr. Nice.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Richard Nice. I'm from the law firm here in Madison of Coyne, Nice, Schultz, Becker, and Bauer, and I will be speaking for Allstate Insurance Company in this appeal. Allstate has petitioned this court to reverse the Court of Appeals decision on a very limited and discrete issue of subrogation law. That issue is wrong as a matter of equity, and it's wrong as a matter of the decisions of this court. It allows the plaintiff a double recovery, which is anathema to subrogation and collateral source law in this state, and it requires Allstate to pay more than its fair share for the liability of its insured. Now, this case only involves $2,000 roughly. That's an insignificant sum in the grand scheme of things, but the principles here, justices, are principles that are important to subrogated insurers who seek to resolve their claims for subrogation, to third-party liability carriers who are interested in buying their piece and that of their insured on subrogated claims, and is certainly important to the trial courts who, under the current decision by the Court of Appeals, are substantially burdened by increased attention to subrogation claims that they need not be involved with.
Mr. Nice, if I can interrupt you for a moment, how do you get around the Kaufman case? As you know, that's a case decided by this court about 2 years ago, and that case seems to be pretty much on point. How do you distinguish that case from your situation?
With all due respect, I don't believe the case is at all on point, and the reason being this. In Kaufman, the subrogated carrier paid less than the full value of the medical expenses in that case, and its claim was then separate from what was left over for the injured party. And basically what the court held in that case is that merely because the subrogated carrier was able to negotiate for less of the medical expenses does not wipe out the claim that the injured party has to a fair and reasonable value of those medical expenses. So there were three principles involved in that case. One, that the injured party is entitled to the fair and reasonable value of the expenses. Number two, that she may collect those irrespective of the collateral source rule, but where there is a liability or a subrogated insurer which pays a portion of those are carved out, and the insured or the injured party has the ability to sue for what the subrogated carrier did not pay. The subrogated carrier can sue for what they did pay, and there is no double recovery.
Well, in this case, didn't Allstate pay less than the actual property damage?
That's certainly true, but they paid their full value of what they owed on the property damage.
Well, that's assuming 70-30 was a correct split.
Correct. That is true. The so in harmonizing the case with Kaufman, Kaufman says that the collateral source rule is not abrogated where there is no risk of double recovery for the insured or for the injured party. Here there is a double recovery. There is not only a risk, it is actualized under the court's Court of Appeals decision.
Can I just, I want to hook on to Justice Crooks's question. Basically, it would make no difference, I'm talking about your theory here, whether it was 60-40, 90-10, it's a matter of whether or not there was a submission. Just so I understand it, it was $7,500 minus the $500 deductible. By the way, that was paid, wasn't it?
Correct. The deductible was paid.
All right. So your issue here is that the property damage claim, which was for $7,500 minus the $5, was fully compensated no matter what the division was between the two insurance companies.
That's correct.
Okay.
The subrogated carrier paid in full.
Yeah, it could have been 59-40, whatever, but okay.
Correct.
I have a question also on the facts. What happened to the rest of Mrs. Paulson's claim? She is actually claiming, at least in her brief, that she suffered $8,700 in damages.
And the Court of Appeals separated that out correctly, as it turns out, under Kaufman, and allowed her to go ahead and proceed with those, but they were settled subsequent to that decision. The only issue before this Court is the amount paid by Midwest and whether any of that reverts to the plaintiff if Allstate, the third-party liability carrier, settles that claim with Midwest for less than the full monetary value of the claim, but full amount of what Allstate owes on the claim under a 70-30 split.
I don't understand that. Couldn't Paulson go after Midwest for $1,159, which is the difference between her total claim and the actual the $7,500 that or $7,000 that her own insurance company paid?
Well, if she contends that she wasn't made whole by the settlement, she could do that. But that's not at issue in this court. Midwest Security is not a party to this. What they're seeking to do is not go after Midwest Security for the additional amount. That was settled. What they're trying to do is get a part of what was settled of Midwest Security's claim and put that into the plaintiff's pocket. So not only did the plaintiff get $7,000 from Midwest Security plus their deductible, which was the entire repair bill, they want another 30% from Allstate on top of that, and that is the double recovery that Kaufman does not allow. And that's why Kaufman doesn't control this case, and that's why Reed versus Bradley was wrongly decided. Oh,
the confusing part, at least I'm talking, I might have been confused, was exactly the question that Justice Babich asked, because it's my understanding that what Judge George did at the trial level was say, no, look, the only thing you can't talk about is that the 70-30 property resolution. Everything else, including the items that Justice Babbage referred to were fair game in the trial. Is that right?
I think that's sort of it.
Okay.
I think the ruling was, and it was incorrect under Kaufman subsequently, I think he ruled that the subrogation claim that was settled by Allstate eliminated the entire property damage law.
But the issue before us, and I'll be talking to your opposing counsel, is basically not a – it's – well, you've simplified it, but it's basically right down to the nitty-gritty, which is that 70-30 split and whether or not that can be brought up again in front of a jury.
That's
okay.
Well, the issue is whether or not Allstate, by settling for 70-30,
right,
has to put the 30 into their pocket and give them a double recovery,
right,
and then pay more than their fair
right
share for their insured's liability.
Well, I'm sorry to stay with this, but I'm still confused. Midwest insures Paulson, correct?
Correct.
And Allstate insures Schott.
Correct.
Paulson had damages, property damages of $8,700.
As it turns out, that was their claim.
Okay. Now, if Allstate, and Allstate is the tortfeasor.
Correct.
Why can't she collect at least up to $8,700 from Allstate?
What the court, well, because $77,000 of it was already paid by Midwest. So what we're talking about is the additional $1,700.
Right.
$500 of it was paid by Allstate, which was the deductible, and which is the fair result of Kaufman.
Right.
All right. So we're talking about the additional $1,200.
But doesn't Allstate still owe her $1,200?
Not, according to the Court of Appeals, that's correct. And that's not at issue here, because that was remanded to the trial court and then settled between the parties. We've taken care of that issue.
Okay, but if in fact Allstate does owe $1,200 more, why should Allstate be allowed to settle with Midwest and then say, oh, no, I don't owe you any more?
Well, as it turns out, that was an incorrect position to take under Kaufman, and the Court of Appeals reversed that, remanded it to the trial court, and that was resolved by settlement between the parties. The only issue before this Court is what's left over in that Midwest settlement, the $7,000, and what happens there with that claim, and does any of that revert to the plaintiff after the plaintiff has been paid for their deductible, after the plaintiff has been allowed to proceed with their additional claim for damages, and after the plaintiff settled that claim for damages.
So what the plaintiff is asking for here, as you see it, is $8,700. Which they've gotten paid $7,500, and the $1,200 is going back, plus an additional $2,000.
Correct.
Correct.
And it's the $2,000. So where do they get the $2,000 from?
The $2,000 is the 30% reduction.
I understand that, but where do they? Why are they entitled to it?
They are clearly not.
I understand that, but what is their claim, and then you tell us why?
As I understand it, their claim is this. Midwest Security was brought into the lawsuit, asserted on the basis of 803.032, I think it is, as a subrogated party. They moved to dismiss, and the plaintiff stipulated a dismissal of their claim because the subrogation claim had been fully paid. And then the plaintiff took the position, there's no subrogation claim in this case because they're not here. So now we get the money. There's no authority for that. There's no justification in equity, and there's no authority in the law for it. And Judge George found that that was not correct. And it's the Court of Appeals that I think has been lost in the thicket of subrogation law, as have I been on occasion.
Could I try to ask a question? If we put aside all claim damages beyond the $7,500, let's say the total liability was $7,500. How much did Allstate pay out?
They paid the $500 deductible and 70% of the remaining $7,000, representing the 70% causal negligence of their insurer.
So they didn't pay out $7,500.
That's correct.
Why shouldn't they?
Because subrogation claims are subject to the same defenses that the claim from which they derive is subject to, and one of those is contributory negligence. This is an intersection accident where the plaintiff failed to exercise.
But you're not entitled to assert contributory negligence against this plaintiff on the particular facts of this case.
That's true, but that isn't what we weren't asserting it against the plaintiff. We were asserting the 30% against the subrogated carrier, which settled long before the suit was filed. And our reference to the 30% is that this is this claim has been taken care of. The subrogated claim, the right belongs to the subrogated carrier, and the subrogated carrier has settled it prior to the default of Allstate. We did not reduce any other damages the plaintiff was seeking by 30%, because at that point Allstate was in default. But at the time that the subrogation claim was in fair play, Allstate was entitled to negotiate on the basis of the contributory negligence, and did in fact. And this was an amicable agreement between the party that owned the claim and the party that paid the claim.
Why couldn't Allstate and Midwest and the plaintiffs, the Paulsons, simply sit down and say, here are the damages, or send a $7,500 check to the Paulsons that's co-signed by Allstate, and then you work out the difference?
Well, you know, if that could happen, we'd get rid of a lot of litigation in this world. I mean, parties go to juries because they can't resolve those kinds of issues. And we have here an issue that the plaintiff raised, that they're entitled to all of it. Every nickel that we paid to Midwest was their position. They owned all of it. And the Court of Appeals split the baby, saying, well, you can't take what Allstate has already paid once, but you can take what Allstate didn't pay, even though Allstate wouldn't have owed it under contributory negligence. There's no basis that I can find in the law that allows a claim that belongs to the subrogated carrier to revert to the plaintiff because the subrogated carrier exercised its right and its discretion to settle the claim as it saw fit.
Well, is it your position that other than the $1,200, which is going to go back and be debated as to whether Paulson had this property damage, right?
Well, it's been settled now.
Okay, it's been settled. If I understand your position is that other than the $1,200, which is now out, they've been fully paid for their property damage. Claim.
Correct.
And on settlement of the $1,200, they are fully paid for their property damage.
Correct.
Regardless of the 30%.
Correct.
And they've picked it up from a combination of Midwest and Allstate.
Correct.
And therefore, they are owed nothing else. They've already been made whole.
That is correct.
That's your position in
That's
a
correct.
Nutshell.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And that giving them anything more would result in the double recovery that Justice Bradley mentioned in the majority decision in Kaufman should not be allowed.
Now, suppose that that Midwest had only paid them 30% on the grounds that there was contributory negligence. Could they do that?
Well, if they did that, they'd probably get sued for bad faith, but I would say that the 70% claim would still belong to the plaintiff under Kaufman, just as the deductible here belongs to the plaintiff. We didn't pay Midwest didn't pay the deductible.
That's what I'm driving
yeah.
at.
Yeah, we're not trying to wipe out what Midwest didn't pay, just what Midwest paid and what is Midwest entitled to do with it. And they made their deal, and it's a deal that should not be disturbed and the money put into the pocket of the plaintiff. It makes no sense, and there's no authority for it, and Kaufman does not control that.
Well, you stand in the shoes of the tortfeasor, right?
Correct.
Are you getting away with something?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. We are paying our full responsibility for the subrogated claim, even though it's a 30% reduction, and this happens in intersection accidents all the time. There's two parties at fault.
So if you were getting away with something and paying less than what your tortfeasor should pay, the public policy is that the plaintiff who was injured should get the benefit of any excess money floating out there, and not the tortfeasor getting the benefit of making a good deal. I mean, I'm overstating it, not quite using the language in the cases, but in effect is the tortfeasor should not get a benefit from the tort.
Well, I think that's true to an extent, but there are cases such as Lambert where the tortfeasor did get a deal, and that's what Justice Bradley in the majority decision clarified. Where there is no risk of double recovery, we're not going to vitiate the collateral source rule.
Did your guy get a good deal?
The insurance company, Allstate, we paid full value.
In fact, 30% is right.
I think we got, you know, we can debate the default, but I think if I had been able to try the case, I could have gotten more than 30% on the plaintiff. But, you know, that's water under the dam. I can't do it now.
Your argument is premised on the assumption that the plaintiff was made whole. Is that correct?
Not necessarily.
Explain that to me, then, why it is not.
The line of cases of dealing with made whole weigh the equities between the subrogated carrier and the plaintiff, and who stands in line first for the what is limited money, either under Garrity or under Rhymes or under Schulte, is limited by agreement of the tortfeasor and the plaintiff. But it's a priority there. The remedy, there's nothing in the made whole law that allows, that says anything about collecting more money out of the third-party tortfeasor. It's a matter of dividing it up between the subrogated carrier and the plaintiff to a limited pot of money. Here, there was an unlimited pot of money given the amount of damages we had here. As a matter of law, there's no made whole issue in this case. She was fully made whole, or could have been if she had pursued her claims instead of settling.
Would our decision in this case arguably be different if the parties had not settled out after the remand?
No, I don't think so. Well, you might not have accepted the review with the record as cluttered as it was at that point. But no, then instead of a settlement on the damages, there would have been a trial on the damages, and then and we may have even conceded the damages just to get up here on this issue. But the issue is resolved, and there is nothing in this record anywhere that suggests that this plaintiff has not been made fully whole.
I bet you the plaintiff doesn't feel like.
Well, then the plaintiff should point to the record, because it's not there. There's plenty of insurance coverage left over after they left the table, and they were paid, as the record shows, a substantial sum of money for this $1,200 plus Allstate sanctions.
Allstate paid the $500 deductible.
Correct.
When did it do that?
It did it. Well, it conceded it before trial, but it paid it after trial as part of the judgment plus the interest that was owed on it.
But, I mean, it didn't come before a lawsuit was filed.
Correct. Because, again, before a lawsuit was filed, contributory negligence was in play, and we had a right to defend it on the basis of contributory negligence. Once the default was entered, at that point, then we owed the $500, and it was conceded. It was not paid until later, but it was paid with the interest owed on it at that point. So the remedy for a late payment has already been done.
But now to get that $500, a lawsuit had to be filed, and I assume the plaintiff had to pay for the attorney for that lawsuit.
Well, it was a limited, small issue in a larger lawsuit. The whole family was suing for personal injury. It was a tag-on issue at best. But, yeah, they had to have a lawyer, but they would have had to have a lawyer anyway if we'd have paid the $500. And this was a personal injury case. The property damage was a small amount. As it turns out, the whole case was fairly small. But the property damage part of this case was peanuts compared to what was claimed in terms of personal injury. I don't know what my time is, but the case is, I think, not controlled by Kaufman. I think Reed versus Bradley was wrongly decided and is distinguishable anyway. The result of the Court of Appeals decision here results in a double recovery for the plaintiff, and the tortfeasor paying more than their fair share for the liability here, and that can't stand under any analysis of the equities of subrogation. And finally, it presumes that a claim that has passed to the subrogated carrier can then revert to the plaintiff, depending upon what the subrogated carrier decides to do with it in terms of settling that claim. And I find no basis for that.
How would you distinguish the Reed case? You said that you felt it was wrongly decided, but you could distinguish it anyway. How would you distinguish it?
Well, Reed was a situation where the subrogated carrier paid 75 or settled for 75% of the claim, but paid 100% of the medical bills, so far pretty much on point. But what wasn't present in Reed versus Bradley is the contributory negligence factor. There was 100% liability stipulated in that case. So there was clearly the tortfeasor was paying 25% less than what they owed on the subrogated claim. That's not present in this case. And, by the way, Reed versus Bradley was cited by and used as controlling by the Court of Appeals, was not cited by either party to this appeal, either to the trial court or to the Court of Appeals, never addressed, and it would control the decision. I will reserve. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Schnecker, representing Peggy Paulson and Douglas Paulson.
My name is Jim Schernecker, and I represent Peggy Paulson, the plaintiff, appellant, respondent, honorable justices of the Supreme Court. A note before I begin my prepared presentation, which will take about 10 minutes. The note will take about 30 seconds. A note that the issue here is preserving and emphasizing Rhimes, that is, the collection of cases starting with Garrity, Rhimes, Schulte, Recker, and Nienaus, in which the procedure and protocol set down by this court and the courts of appeals requiring that if there is a dispute over subrogation, that you go to a Rhimes procedure ought in any event be preserved and clarified. Little tags in the decisions are making a lot of litigation, such as there being no terms in the contract to the contrary.
Well, that line of cases, counsel, is not implicated here. It only applies if there's a question of priority of payment when there's a limited pool of money. There's not a make-whole issue here.
May I respectfully state that it's totally irrelevant whether there's a limited pool of money before the settlement. Rhimes controls, first of all, we don't know what the damages are. There's been no finding of fact by any fact finder on what her damages are, and it's controlling. The property damage is the dog, not the tail in this case. There's been no finding by a court as to what her damages are. That's why it was remanded.
The Court of Appeals did not read this as a make-whole issue or a Rhimes-Garrity issue.
I understand. I respectfully stand on that, that is the a pivot point for this whole case. And I share the unease of civil trial counsel that this is a horrible factual scenario, and I would suggest to the court that you ignore the dollar amounts and stick with preserving the protocol and the reasoning and the rules of law of Rhimes, which, of course, our main position is going to be as a matter of equity. Here you have two corporate giants going off into their own secret world, making elbowing themselves ahead of any determination on made whole. Nobody made any made whole, and there's been three representations by my colleague that we've solved or resolved and settled all claims. I respectfully take exception to that. The document starts out limited compromise agreement. But plaintiff Peggy Paulson is willing to do away with all the dollar amounts and just present to this court the preservation of a clear Rhimes rule. Number one, that the damages belong to the plaintiff. Repeatedly through Allstate's brief, they say that Midwest and then Allstate owns it. That was disapproved in Garrity at 546, 77-546. And on the same page, Garrity says that there can be no sharing of the funds from a tortfeasor unless and until the plaintiff is made whole. They don't talk about whether or not there's a shortage of settlement funds.
Well, counsel, let me just ask you, just look at in the facts of this case and looking at the collateral source rule in subrogation. Now, We know this, at least, well, you can tell me whether I'm right or wrong. At least the amount of $7,542.44 has been paid. $7,042 of that was the 70-30 split, and then we know, at least unless counsel is incorrect or the brief is, that $500 was then paid. So that basically the total property issue was $8,701. The difference between $7,500 and $8,700 is $1,200. Opposing counsel is saying, well, wait a minute, they're asking for $2,000 in addition to the $1,200. Am I wrong?
What we're asking for is $8,700 and disregard any payments. Number one.
Oh, wait, no, just a minute. So you're only asking for $1,200 then?
No, sir. We're asking for $8,700, but I'm saying at this point, this court should disregard all the dollar amounts and not award a nickel in the interest of preserving the Rhymes rule. Don't get caught up in the dollar amounts.
Well, I think what about the subrogation rule? And that's what I'm trying to figure
out. Yes, sir. Yeah. And there is no subrogation until, number one, we know what the damages are. There's no facts on damages. Number two, is the plaintiff made whole? There's
the facts,
no evidence.
The facts of damages are not $8,700?
Absolutely not.
As far as property?
With respect, sir, there's been no finding by a finder of fact. That's what we have made an offer of proof on.
But you said in your brief that the Paulson property damage totals $8,701.
That's correct. That's in the record. That's our affidavits. But there's been no finding of fact.
Well, let's assume that it is, that you're correct. $8,700. She's already received $7,500. If she gets an additional $8,700, which you say you're asking for in property, sounds to me like that's a pretty big enrichment for her.
Well, it's enrichment.
No matter how many zeros you put after it, it's far more than what her actual property damage is.
It's enrichment if Allstate and Midwest played by the rules. They decided to go outside into another world of corporate make-your-own rules. And the interests of the injured innocent party be damned.
Well,
I don't understand it. It just seems to me like Mrs. Paulson has gotten $7,500, and apparently this other $1,200 or $1,100, whatever that amount is, and I'm disregarding the figures, has been taken care of by way of settlement. So how has she not been made whole?
That was not taken care of by settlement. And first of all, this court certainly has the power to decide issues of fact, but we're talking about a disputed, limited compromise that ordinarily this court refers back to the trial court for resolution. And what I'm saying is, given the dollar amounts, on behalf of Peggy Paulson, I'm asking this court to forget the dollar amounts and focus simply on the Rhymes rule as developed in Garrity, Rhymes, Schulte.
And what is that rule?
Number one, that if the carriers, such as Allstate and Midwest, want protection and want to do something other than extrajudicial maneuvering and negotiations without participation of the legal system, they've got to follow Rhymes, which is what we say over and over.
But what is that rule?
The rule is, number one, they got to plead it. Number two, that at the end of the trial or as a matter of negotiation while the trial is going on or just negotiations before there's any litigation.
In other words,
everybody comes together.
Yeah, in other words, I did sit on the trial bench for 14 years and with all due modesty, probably looked at hundreds or thousands of these over that time this is sort of a typical auto accident. You're saying that first you got to get a lawyer, then you got to plead it out, and there can be no where insurance company, corporate entity A and corporate entity B that are the covering parties can say, well, it's 60-40, 90-10, 70-30. Isn't that standard within the industry of how these things are resolved?
Two premises.
I'm just asking, I know you've been an attorney and for several years and, and have you know, experience in this field. I'm just asking. That's the way that at least my experience has been.
You've never had a case, Your Honor, during a pending litigation where the insurance company went out of the court and over to the, I can't think of the name, the Midwest, the initial subrogee, and made a deal with them, and then came back into court and said, Judge, the plaintiff has to reduce her claim of damages to the jury because we've settled this case 70-30 or 90-10. But you never ran into that.
May I ask, was that done in this case? That is what I've read the fact that I didn't see. Is that what happened here?
Well, in this case, it even stepped back further.
Yes.
Now we're back into pre-litigation because they know they can get away with it.
And that's what I'm talking about, because that was what I'm asking, if that isn't how, you know, we have the subrogation and that's how, you know, we owe this and we owe that. That's how it normally happens.
No, sir, I disagree.
Hey,
number one.
Well, I'm asking.
Yeah. Under Rhines, whether you call it timing or precedential or seriatim, however you want to say it, unless the plaintiff is made whole, there is no maintainable or viable subrogation agreement.
Well, Justice,
Garrity.
Justice Babich's question is one I would not expand on, but just he was saying, well, look, we know in this case you're saying forget these figures, but they were presented to us in the briefs that there's $7,542.44 paid. You in your brief indicated that there was a total of $8,701, which is, as I said, the $1,200. Now, I hope I don't misstate his question. Are you saying, well, now, look, when you have that amount, which is $8,700, and you're saying, well, forget all of that because here they did not follow procedure. So you're saying because they didn't do that, that's why we should look at Rhines, and that is what you're trying to extend to this court, that that's the way it should be done.
No, sir.
Okay.
What I'm saying is you've got so many complex, highly unique fact situations that whatever rulemaking decision comes out of this court should be independent of those facts. You've got to find the facts in regard to a limited compromise. Again, this court has the power, but I don't think you should be doing it. You've got to remand it. More exhaustion of judicial remedies. You got another mixed issue on what the default judgment is. And we're talking about $1,700 or $1,200, whatever it is, and on behalf of the client, we're willing to waive any dollar amount for the good of the rulemaking power of this court, which is to be emphatic that if Allstate or any carrier like it wants to engage in subrogation negotiations, they at least have to bring in the insured person and get their okay, or better, it should be settled in front of a court because you're talking tremendous disparity of power.
Let's say the subrogation claim had not been compromised between the two insurance companies pretrial and had been part of the proofs. What would the property damage line item have been on the damages award?
Well,
8,000 something.
Assuming everything went our way, the loss of value was 8,500 and the repairs were 8,700. So we've got to take the lesser of the two. Loss of value, 8,500. If Mr. Nice somehow failed in his superhuman efforts and we got a zero negligence on us, then we would get $8,500.
Okay.
And then you got a Rhines hearing after that to determine how much Midwest is going to get.
And Midwest would get theoretically the $7,500 or however much the amount of the repair bill was.
Well, and then we had $559 for a new steering box that they didn't pay,
okay.
And we had $600 for brakes, and the car still doesn't steer right. We're contending it's salvage.
But you've recovered that difference, haven't you?
That's under all the rules, ma'am, assuming everybody followed the rules. Our main contention is...
That's what I'm asking. You've already recovered that difference between whatever the maximum amount of property damage you would have recovered had everything gone your way, and minus the amount that you would have had to pay to Midwest on the subrogation claim. You've got that in your pocket, right?
No, ma'am. We were paid for some matters that are rather delicate in the Court of Appeals decision that we're not going to get into.
You've compromised it.
Yes.
And now you're asking for more.
No. I am saying that this court, as a rulemaking body and considering the administrative function of this court, that it's vastly more important that you take a cue from civil trial counsel. Repeatedly in their brief, their amicus brief, they say, this is a horrible record. Shuck the record. Shuck these mixed findings of fact that have to be sent back to the trial court. We're willing to give up $1,200 or whatever it is, or even $8,500 under the collateral source rule, and say, make it very clear that Rhymes means what it says, that if you want to be protected, Mr. Subrogee, that you play within the rules.
Was the Rhymes-Garrity issue even raised by you in the Court of Appeals?
Well,
or did that just come into this case with the amicus involvement at this court?
It's sure in our brief, but...
It's in your brief here, I know. Did you raise it in front of the Court of Appeals? Because the Court of Appeals did not look at this as a make-whole case.
Our main thrust there was the collateral source rule, which you don't get to, as you've written, unless you first found that there is no maintainable or viable subrogation claim. And I think those rules have to be clarified and made clear so that that you don't have the powerful people going off and making deals that unfairly impact on those who haven't a clue as to what's going on.
So I guess the answer to my question is no, and that the make-whole dimension to this case is new after the acceptance of the petition for review.
I don't agree.
And that this was treated as a case involving the intersection of the collateral source rule and the law of subrogation.
I don't agree.
Is that not a fair statement?
No.
Do you have your Court of Appeals brief? Well, look at page 5.
Well, page 4, we cite all the cases I've been talking about today, and on page 5, thank you, Madam Chief Justice, we make sub A, capital letter A, Paulson has not been made whole.
I'm not sure it's exactly the same argument you're making about Rhymes here about what they have to all do, but you do make a make whole argument. The problem I have with your argument, and I think you've heard it from, if I understood the questions of my colleagues, is that it would appear to us, or to me, at first blush, that you are made whole. If your claim is for $8,700, if your claim was for $7,500, you've been made whole. Now, I gather that after you settled with Midwest, you had these other expenses. Is that correct?
When we settled with Midwest, we never settled with Midwest.
Well, after you got $7,000 from Midwest, right?
Well,
is that when you incurred additional expenses for repairing the car?
Midwest paid the insured with a check made out to the repair company before the people ever came in the office. So you can say they settled, but that's not the way I would use the word. And then the people claimed numerous trips back to the garage, which the trial court awarded them that time, and they incurred another $1,100 in expenses, which and the car was totaled or salvaged under the statute.
Your argument is you haven't been made whole because a full accounting of all the damages and a dispute as to whether you get repairs or salvage value is still in the air as far as you're concerned.
Yes.
That's your argument.
Yes, ma'am.
And that they can't take that away from you by this private settlement. That is, Allstate and Midwest can't take that away from you by a private settlement, because under Rhymes, you have to be part of that deal.
Yes, ma'am.
That's your argument.
Well, wait. I thought you acknowledged and conceded that you settled the claim for the additional repair costs. And what we're talking about is that differential between the total initial repair bill and what that repair bill was compromised at between the two insurance carriers, the first-party carrier and the tortfeasors, the third-party carrier. And that's what we're fighting about here, that $2,100 or whatever the figure is. The additional repair costs, the additional trips to the repair shop, the brakes, the loss of use, et cetera, that's all been compromised, is off the table, is not in front of us.
The specific words in the limited compromise agreement with my worthy colleague was, and any additional amounts that the Supreme Court may award. And the caption was, limited compromise. We understood, and again, now we're into at least a mixed question of fact and law, which I don't think this court wants to get into. And to protect against exhausting more resources and sending it back to the trial court, I'm suggesting you drop all the dollar amounts and let us go our way with no more money. But again, making very clear as a matter of rulemaking that under Rhymes, that if you're a carrier and you want to make, and we encourage carriers to make settlements, we have no disagreement with that, but keep it above board, even Mary Jane settlements, you got to tell the court and the other parties. All of this has got to see the light of day, or in the coin of that's current, transparent. You can't have the two muscle-bound people making their agreement and then coming back to the injured person who's blameless and saying, here, you take it, and that's too bad.
What was the amount of the repair bill?
There was three repair bills. As the Court of Appeals called it, the initial repair bill was $7,542. Over the following month, 2 months, they went back to the garage and had $559 put in for a steering box, and the car still pulls to the left. That's in affidavits. And then we got $600 for three replacements of brake parts.
The initial repair bill was that $7,500. That's the claim between you and your first-party carrier, Midwest. And we're discussing in this case, and what's at issue in this case, is that differential between that $7,500 repair bill that the subrogated carrier, Midwest, had a subrogation claim for, and what it compromised it at, which was the 70% figure. And that is what is at issue in this case. And your client was not going to be entitled to a penny of that $7,500 in the first place because of the subrogation claim. Is that not correct?
Correct.
And now you want...
Initially. No, not now. There's 15 steps in between. Number one is the equity. We're talking equitable subrogation, equitable made whole. What are the equities of the plaintiff? She's blameless. What are the equities of Allstate and Midwest? They dumped and discarded Rhymes and went off on their own. And what is the law?
But you just said that she's not entitled to a penny of that $7,500.
That's correct.
But you're arguing that now she is.
No, I'm saying that under the made whole rule, when you get down to the end and you say that there is no viable or enforceable subrogation claim, now the collateral source rule steps in and says you get your $8,500 regardless of the $7,542, and that's Valley Forge, where $6,000 was paid to the person twice for the same damage to the car, and the issue is the same, weighing the equities. And if as a matter of rule, and we will forever make no claim for a penny before this court. All we're saying is we would appreciate a clarification that Rhymes applies to everybody. And if you go outside of Rhymes, you do so at your peril.
So in other words, you're not – what you want from this Court is that until they have retained or worked with the individual insurers, that any resolution that they have made would not be acceptable. In other words, under Valley Forge, under the other Rhymes and Garrity, you're saying in this situation, because they were violative of those rules, they being the corporate entities here, stand to possibly pay a double recovery because they didn't play by the rules. Is that?
That's correct.
And what if that's not equitable?
Pardon?
What if that's deemed not equitable? What if my sense of equity is that you should be made whole, however you define that, but not twice whole as a punishment? You would be made twice whole because they didn't follow the Rhymes procedure. You know, what if in all of that, my sense of equity is, okay, what you deserve to be done is made whole.
Don't give us a dime, Justice. We're not looking for a dime at this point.
What you're looking for is apparently a rule that says if the insurance companies settle out an intersection accident and between themselves decide it's 70-30, 60-40 for all that's been paid, that cannot in any way be binding on the plaintiff unless the plaintiff is made a part of those negotiations. Is that what you're looking for?
That's a good start.
And signs off? I mean, how would you handle if you were doing the decision? What would you say? What type, at what point does this become a valid? Do they call up and say, here's what we're going to do, and the 18-year-old says, that looks good to me, and okay, we have your permission, you're an adult, and then the father and the mother or the guardian come in and say, well, gee, that's we shouldn't have settled so soon. I mean, how do you write that rule?
Settle it as you would any other claim. That's the best. The rest would be problematical. I don't want to complicate it.
Mr. Shelker, I'm reading from page 13 of your brief. This is your prayer for relief. This is what you're asking for. Paulson has not been made whole. Allstate stipulated and agreed to not raise any liability defenses. Allstate has not pled subrogation and by its stipulation is precluded from doing so. The equities in this case weigh heavily in favor of Paulson. And then you ask us to affirm the Court of Appeals as to the culpability and modify the Court of Appeals with respect to the issue of property damage. This doesn't sound anything like the argument you're making today.
Yes, sir. I agree.
Well, maybe then my confusion is justified.
Yes, and I apologize.
Where in your brief do you argue for us with respect to Rhymes and reasserting this issue? Where, when I go back into my office and start trying to write this case, and I reread the briefs, where do I find this this argument that you've made today? Is that page 9?
Make a claim of a contributory negligence and some defenses like that. But after writing that and walking around the block a couple of times,
happened to me.
the whole idea of dealing with these mixed questions of law and fact over the amount of money that's involved, I can't justify it. Maybe the court, and of course, its wisdom would think different, but.
Counsel, where is the limited agreement you have? I don't see it in your appendices, but maybe I've missed it. And then when you answer, please stand in front of the microphone, because otherwise we don't get it taped.
Yes, ma'am. It's in the appendix provided by Mr. Or by Allstate.
What page?
Appendix. Give me your appendix.
I don't see it in the table of contents for his appendix. Okay, where is it in the record? You're reading from the record now?
It's in the motion by Allstate to expand the record.
Okay, and what's the record page number?
Your Honor, this was filed subsequent to the plaintiff's brief, and it's in Defendant Petitioner Allstate Insurance Company's motion to supplement the record.
Okay, thank you. All right, it's not in here. I have a question for you, and I haven't read it, obviously, because I don't have it in front of me, and I have not read this entire record. Why isn't this case moot? You all have settled this out. You're coming in here asking for an advisory opinion on, I mean, this is, I'm posing this, you can answer. And Mr. Nice, I'd expect you to answer in your rebuttal. And then it's great to ask us for an advisory opinion and advise all the insurance carriers, et cetera, but that's not something we generally do because you don't really get all the facts. You're telling us to ignore the facts. So what's your answer to that?
Sure. As formulated, you have in front of you at least a claim for $1,200.
But you settled.
No.
You haven't settled. Okay.
Don't agree. It's a limited compromise, and the phrasing that I would rely on, and again, I would submit to the court that all the questions in regard to what that agreement provides or doesn't provide should be remanded. And what I'm saying is that as a matter of conserving the court's resources, you skip by all of that.
Let me just ask you another question. Can we just, for your purposes, just affirm the Court of Appeals?
Oh, boy. I think that buries Rhymes.
Okay. That's what I...
What they've done is made a labyrinthian or Byzantine industry out of Rhymes. In fact, there's firms in right here in Madison who are drafting legislation in an attempt to control subrogation claims. So it's not just in this forum that the matter is causing considerable concern.
Because as I read the Court of Appeals, it goes back to the circuit court just to enter a judgment for you for $2,112.73, right?
Yes.
You don't want that.
No.
You want it to go back and open this all up so you can be made whole as to whatever you can prove to make you whole. Is that the point?
With the rule, I can represent to this court that this case will never see the light of day again. I will never go back to the trial court. Not going back. I mean, I would be embarrassed to come back in front of a circuit judge and take up the time. But I think it's vitally important that Rhymes be emphasized, because over and over, this same thing is happening in the trial courts where the tortfeasor's carrier and the subrogee are making a side deal and then coming in and saying your damages are reduced before you ever get to the jury and before you ever get to a Rhymes case. Or as far as negotiating, it's a real concern.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Nice.
Thank you. Justices, I'd like to address two points which concern me in the presentation of Mr. Schernecker. First of all, the point raised by Madam Chief Justice as to the mootness issue. Certainly this is the first we've heard that they're not looking for damages, and I'm not sure yet whether they're looking for damages. Sometimes he is, sometimes he isn't. But I, my understanding is at best you have a conditional waiver. We won't look for the damages if we get an opinion. And I don't know that he's made a all-out waiver, and I would be very, very concerned if this court would moot this on the basis of this oral argument, because we have out there sitting the Court of Appeals decision, which is published. Frankly, this court would never have seen this case if it hadn't been published. Reed versus Bradley is out there, and you're going to get it again. It is spawning mischief and will continue to spawn mischief. It is not a moot point. There's $2,100 at issue here. I direct the court to the motion to supplement the record. All property damage claims other than those paid by Midwest Security were specifically and explicitly released. We are talking about the $2,100 that Allstate did not pay.
Well, what kind of opinion do you want written?
I would like the court to, consistent with the Kaufman case, say that when the insured has been made whole, we don't make them more than whole by requiring money go back from the settlement of the subrogated insurer's claim into the plaintiff's pocket. It's a natural extension of that decision. It's not at all at odds with it.
How will that?
I'm sorry, but you answered Justice Bradley, and I did not quite understand you. She asked you, is your argument premised totally on made whole? And you answered no.
Correct.
And I had led you through questioning that made it appear to me that it was totally premised on made whole.
I think I said it's based on assuming that the insured was made whole.
By the on the property damage issue.
Yes, but just talking about property.
All right. Damage. I can't emphasize enough how this is not a made whole case, as Justice Sykes has stated. The Court of Appeal, it couldn't be. There are two factors involved in a made whole equation. One is, what is the value of the case? Two, what is the available proceeds to pay for the case? At the Court of Appeals level, they remanded part of it, and so half of the equation was not even addressed. The court could not have gotten to made whole at that point. It was not an issue appropriately. So when on remand, it is incumbent upon the parties to either make a record relative to made whole, which was not done here, because it was settled. Now, Mr. Schernecker gave up the made whole argument when he settled the case at the court of appeal, or at the trial court level.
You know, one of the things that's confusing me, counsel, is when the chief just asked you essentially, how would you write this opinion? What would it stand for? And your very first words were, when the insured is made whole, we do not make him more than whole. Your very first words in response to how do you write this opinion assumes, you said, when the insured is made whole. So I just don't understand how you start that as your very basic premise and then say you're not assuming made whole here. I know the elements that you speak of, and yet there's something in this case where made whole is intertwined, and it's not totally apparent to me, but it's there just because of, in part, your response. When the insured is made whole, we do not make him more than whole. That's what you want the first premise of the opinion to be.
Well, and I think we have to presume that the insured was made whole, because there is no basis in this record to assume otherwise.
Let me come at this a little bit differently. What is wrong with the Court of Appeals' opinion that you believe needs to be corrected?
The Court of Appeals' decision should allow the settlement between the subrogated carrier and Allstate to stand as it is, and none of the money that was negotiated for reduction due to the contributory negligence of the plaintiff should go to the plaintiff, which has already received 100% of her damages from.
But is there anything as a matter of law with the court in error with respect to the Court of Appeals opinion?
Yes. The Court of Appeals decision relies on Reed versus Bradley, which is at odds with Kaufman v. Lightfuss.
Okay.
Are you finished?
Yeah.
Chief, may I ask a question?
Go ahead.
Let's say in this fact situation, there was not this extra $1,200. There was no claim for the steering box and for the repair of the brakes. None of the, you just had a certain amount that was paid. My hypothetical isn't working out, so I'll withdraw it.
We've all had that problem today.
I think Mr. Justice Wilcox may have a question.
No, I think it's been answered indirectly by the other questions, so I don't want to
prolong this. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Neese, and thank you, Mr. Schernicke, in arguing this case, which apparently, as you can tell, the court has had a difficult getting its arms around. Thank you, and that ends our hearing in 010991. The students should return if they're leaving.